papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is an opportunity for us to give you some insight if we do our job very well. Otherwise, you can just get some commentary and analysis on the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, and I'm here with Dr. Alan Shartok. Say something, Alan.
Something.
Good work, man. Okay. So we've heard from Alan today. He's the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, so actually we do intend to be very nice to Alan, as usual, here on this program.
Right? Can we take a vote on that?
You'll take a vote. That's Ira Fussfeld, who is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York, and its affiliated publications.
Nice to see you all.
Great to see you as well. And here's Judy Patrick, the vice president of the New York Press Association. Ta-da.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, how about that? Judy was the editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady and had a wonderful career in journalism. Well, I mean, in newspapers before turning to...
more esoteric kind of things.
More esoteric.
And put the grind of putting out a daily newspaper.
Yeah, supporting the industry in general.
But like many of us who were in the newspaper business and decided to get out, all of a sudden there are less lines on our face and there's less stomach aches and less Pepto-Bismol. So there's something to say for it. Keep that in mind, Rex.
Fortunately, I'm a very young man. Isn't that right, Alan?
You're very young.
Thank you.
And you have a wonderful publisher who really likes you. So you're in good shape.
Yeah, yeah. George Hurst, a terrific presence in the community in many ways. So listen, this is a banner month in some respects. That is this. It was the biggest month ever for Donald Trump's attacks on the press. There is something called the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. And among other things, they track his anti-press tweets. The president posted 55 anti-press tweets, which is the most for a single month since December of 2015. So he is actually stepping up his attacks on the press. I guess we shouldn't be surprised.
Well, he's not the first president to be an attacker of the press, but the relentlessness of his attacks and the vitriol of his attacks seems to me and to many of us as a step beyond and particularly dangerous in a time that is fraught with danger and a lot of people out there who don't need to be pushed too far to do something stupid and dangerous. And it's certainly never going to stop because he believes it works for him.
That's the question. Is it working? I mean, is it working for him?
Well,
I suspect with that base of his, he thinks he has no choice. The press is going to go after him, except for the New York POST. And unless he comes up against them, he is a big loser. So he does what I think he is a big loser, but I think that's what he's going to do.
Yeah, that's why we as journalists need to step up and hold him accountable. Say, this is not true. And, you know, the press is doing it in many respects, the national press, but I think the local dailies and weeklies have a job to do here is to reinforce the fact that we are important, we do not tell lies, and that we are a valuable contributor to our society.
It's difficult, I think, when you look across the country at the 1,500 or so daily newspapers and the thousands of weekly newspapers that are serving their communities. I think even in each of those instances, there has been a loss of community support, don't you think, because of that affiliation, that sense that it's the same thing as what the president's talking about?
The notion of fake news has caught on with a vast number of people in this country. And I was listening to an interview, a podcast that Alec Baldwin does for Public Radio in New York City, and he was interviewing Adam Schiff, and Adam Schiff was talking about this subject and the media landscape. And when he was a kid, everybody gathered around the TV set and watched one of the three major broadcasters, Cronkite or Huntley Brinkley, but there was a sense of shared information and believable information. And now, in Schiff's words, and he's not the first to say it, is that people are choosing what news they want to read or listen to. And that just has such damage, well beyond the fate of the newspaper industry and the broadcast industry, is that people in this country are walking around with two sets of facts. There are people who don't believe that Trump is a liar. There are people who don't know what the Mueller report is. I mean, how can you have life in a democratic, intelligent society when there are these kinds of splits in basic information?
Well, Ira, you've put your hand right on the issue. I believe this president would like to lead us into, you know, at very best, a strongman form of government, which he admires so much. And one of the things that all dictators and others do is to grab a hold of the press and to hold it. Now, you know, there are some, like the New York Post, which I already talked about, who take the president's side. They do it all the time. So it isn't as if every single press agency is in a different spot. But it is interesting to me that it is all part and parcel of what the strong man does.
You know, the difficulty is that with the decline that would be happening in print specifically anyway because of the digital onslaught, combined with the loss of confidence in journalism in general, I think, Ira, you're right that a lot of people just are tuning out and giving up any concern about paying attention to the news at all. There are an awful lot of people who have just given up the habit of paying attention, and we have a much more ignorant electorate as a result. Just this week, last week, as we're speaking, this wonderful newspaper in Youngstown, Ohio, the Youngstown Vindicator. Isn't that a great name for a newspaper? The Vindicator. After 150 years, they announced that they are closing. And Youngstown is a community that is, what is it, about 60,000?
I thought I read 540,000 people. It's a lot. This is not a minor newspaper just falling off the cliff.
A family-owned paper. It broke their hearts, they were quoted as saying.
200,000, I believe. Indicator reaches 100,000 readers a day online and in print, serving a community twice that size.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's a big community, therefore, to not have its own newspaper.
Well, one of the things that interested me about that, beyond the size of the newspaper and its collapse, is that they didn't apparently take any in-between steps. In fact, they talked about that they weren't going to take in-between steps, the first one being, and as it's happened elsewhere, is reducing the number of days they publish. I mean, they just went from 7 to 0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you would think there may be some other corporate response that could have happened here. Still, the question is, what are we to do if there isn't financial support? And I should say this before we turn on the microphones. Ira was complaining that there was a story he wanted to read on TimesUnion.com, and then he hit the paywall, you know, and couldn't get the story. Ira, you got to pay for journalism.
I understand. Well, you know, I do buy a number of papers online and in print, but I keep my eye on the Times Union. But you're right, and the strategy working for you guys. Just for the readers will know, I saw a tweet about a story that the Times Union had gone into a partnership with the Racing Association in advance of the Saratoga meet, and that interested me, and I want to read it, and I clicked through the tweet, got to the story, saw the headline, saw a nice picture of Rex with the partners, and that was as far as I could go.
Yeah. Gee.
If this was a coin operated and I said, oh, it's 38 cents for the story, I would have dropped the coins in.
Well, and there are efforts to do micropayments,
interesting.
And I think that that's been talked about for years, but it hasn't really quite happened. We have a dynamic pay meter that is working. That is, once you get to a certain number of serious journalism pieces, you have to pay for it. If you're in a certain area, you can look at all the photo galleries you want to, and you don't have to pay, but
you said something that I found very interesting, and you were talking about the digital content versus the print content. And as more newspaper, I know I, among others, would say, okay, print is dying. There at some point in time will be no more print newspapers, but that will not be the end of the newspapers because we'll still be printing our newspaper online. But I'm wondering, and at least in using my own experience, is that I don't read the digital editions nearly as closely as I do the print edition.
Right.
You can't turn the page as you can in print and say, oh, look at that story that I, and it's very easily missed in digital.
So has there been research on that, Rex? I mean, because it is interesting. I read the New York Times a couple of times every night, and I think I get to most of it. I get to most of it that I want to get to. I don't get to the things I don't want to get to, Ira.
Yeah, but you don't know what you might like that you're missing by not turning that digital page, and that is part of the difficulty. We do measure now, and increasingly newsrooms are paying attention, not to page views, which is what used to drive that concern about, oh, clickbait, you're just trying to get clicks, you know. Increasingly, the metric that we're paying attention to is engagement, different kinds of metrics that determine, like, how much time do you spend on each story, what kinds of stories get more time. If you can get a story, by the way, that somebody spends 90 seconds on, that's a big deal. And you can get a big investigative piece. People may spend a few minutes, but if your average number on a story is 130, that's just
terrific. Well, think about it. 90 seconds, if you were reading a story in the newspaper for 90 seconds, that barely gets you through five or six paragraphs.
Well, you're a slow reader. But I mean,
I was going to say.
Sorry. I know, Alan.
I had a question for you, Rick. I interviewed a guy the other day who was very smart. He is against horse racing. And you ran his blog for a long time. Apparently, he doesn't do the blog anymore, his anti-horse racing blog for you. But you do a tremendous amount of good work with the people at the Saratoga Racing people. Does that kind of conflict occur in an editor's mind?
Well, it's interesting. We cover the most popular sports event in our community, which is the Saratoga Race Meet.
Right.
Our advertising department derives some money from NYRA, which is the entity that sponsors the racing. And our marketing department has this partnership where there's, I don't know, there's money that changes hands. I'm not totally clear on who pays what to whom. But in the newsroom, we think we need to cover it. Now, we have done significant reporting about how many horses died, why. We have done reporting into what happens on the race courses and into the some of the controversy about horse racing. I guarantee we will be reporting that further as the race meet goes on this year. So I just think that to not cover horse racing in this community would be to ignore an important part of what people are doing.
Well, think about the implications. If the epidemic of horse deaths that is happening elsewhere in the country starts to include Saratoga during this meet, and if you get a half a dozen horses that die on the track or in the training, then you're going to be faced with the cries, as was the case in Santa Anita in California. They ought to shut this place down. It's not safe, etc. Can you imagine what the tug of war would be? Because nobody wants to see these dead horses on the track. But we also don't want to shut down this area's, I would imagine, this area's biggest moneymaker in terms of tourism and related businesses. It's quite a tug of war.
But you will have those deaths. We do have about a dozen horse deaths annually at Saratoga. And that does happen. Right in front of the fans there. And so I think it's a good question, will this survive? You know, boxing was at one time the most popular sport in America. Horse racing was at one time as big as basketball is now. And it is not the sport that it was in terms of popular appeal. But you're right. What happens if that, we'll be there to cover it, I hope, one way or another, in terms of how both sides of the controversy.
But everybody has this issue. I mean, here WAMC takes underwriting from all corners. Surely there will be somebody who says, you shouldn't take underwriting from these people because I don't happen to agree with them.
Well, I think we're sort of veering a little bit, but the reason this has become such a big topic now, and it's certainly not new, horses have died in and around the tracks for decades, is the volume has gone up, particularly in California and Santa Anita, where we're talking about 30 or so deaths in a very short amount of time. And that's what's caused the angst out there.
And people often do that. They will complain that you're accepting financial backing from somebody or other. If there are ads in the paper, for example, for a gun shop, people get mad at us and they say, how dare you support the American gun industry? This is not our job. Well, those of us who are journalists here.
Well, right. I'm sorry, Judy, just the opposite, though, is that if you start covering horse deaths with the attention that it deserves, then you're going to hear a loud cry from people who are saying, what are you trying to do? You're trying to kill our track, no pun intended.
That'll be interesting.
I was going to make the point that the gun shop owner, who, if he is an advertiser in the newspaper, will complain if you run a story about gun rights or gun sales and you don't call him. That is the perennial problem you have when you're dealing with advertisers as well. Why didn't you call me?
Yeah, why didn't you call me?
Why didn't you cover me?
Right. You do get the back and forth, and we try to explain to people, look, advertising doesn't affect the coverage. If it did, we wouldn't write about deaths on highways because the automobile industry doesn't like that. Or there are many examples of that, but people don't necessarily believe that. They say, well, if you have have a financial affiliation that affects your
coverage. It could even be benign. I mean, I can recall years ago that when we did travel-related stories and they would call, our staff would call a couple of different travel agencies. If we didn't call the travel agency that was a big advertiser, he or she would get upset because they looked at it as free advertising. Why did you let our competitors in the paper?
Mm-hmm. So if you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok.
And if you listen real carefully, Murray the dog.
Murray's in the background there. Yes, it's always nice to have some background noise in the Shartok household, Alan. It's great to hope you enjoyed your breakfast. There we are. So
I did.
It's a great thing. We haven't really had a chance to talk about the impact of the presidential debates, which was a big deal in the media because the numbers are in. 18.1 million viewers tuned in to the Democratic debates, making it the most, that is not tonight too, making it the most watched Democratic primary debate ever, on top of the 15.5 million who watched Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. There were almost as many, 15.3 million on the first night of the debates. So 18 million is especially interesting when you consider the fact that only 30 million people voted in all the 2016 Democratic primaries. So if you've already reached 18 million people, not all of whom are Democrats, of course, but you've reached this many millions of people, that is a significant record, which is a good thing in terms of people paying attention to the news. Right.
And that doesn't include any number that were streaming the content as well. And that very well could be in the millions. We talked earlier about maybe the public doesn't care about the news or disengage, but this is a good sign that at least they do care about this presidential contest.
Well, I wonder how much people think there's a spectacle, that they're less interested in what these people are saying than they are in what these people look like and who's going to catch who in some major faux pas. I've been saying for a lot longer than Bill Maher, who said it again on his program the other night, I hate these debates when there is an audience. If I was to be the emperor of debates, I would have every debate in a studio without an audience, the only people in the room, the participants and the questioners. I just think it makes a circus out of it, and so we'll see. But it's awfully early.
You know what? Circus schmirkus. But the fact of the matter is it makes a huge difference. So, for example, we have Kamala Harris right now, who goes from way down in some polls within a point of Joe Biden. So these are really important. And I think part of it is the passion that exists in this country with respect to this president, who many people, I'm one of them, really can't stand. And so they were looking for who it was that they thought could take on this president. And apparently they don't think Biden has what it takes, and they think that Harris does. So therefore, it became a very important thing. Ira, you just may not like the fact that there's an audience reaction or whatever. But the fact is, it is terribly important that we have this opportunity.
But consider the role of the debate moderators in talking about the media handling of this. One of the most important moment of the two nights of the debate was surely when Kamala Harris confronted Joe Biden and said, "Your words were very hurtful to me. I was on that school bus as a child when there was busing." And the producers, I should say the director, sitting in the control truck, and apparently the president of NBC News, Andy Lack, was there in the truck, allowed this to go on. The moderators did not step in and say, "I'm sorry, Senator, your time is up." They let this confrontation happen, which was a dramatic moment. And I actually think that's great news, because sometimes the over-reliance on the rules and on saying, "No, you only have 30 seconds here," precludes real debate, precludes people from really having those moments. On the other hand, you know, others may say, no, she didn't follow the time constraints and therefore she got an unfair edge.
Well, I like Kamala Harris. I remember talking about her many months ago in this era, and the reason I remember it is because I mispronounced her name and I heard about it. But it just seems to me that this moment is a disproportionate opportunity for her to make gains in the polls. And I guess what I'm saying is this moment enough? Should this moment be enough to change the polls the way it did? There's more than just this one moment going on, certainly to run for president and to be president. And TV is a medium that can highlight something like this. It's a great soundbite. The clips are going to show forever. It is what it is. I'm just saying it's important. I agree with Alan, but I'm wondering whether it's become disproportionately important.
You know, it's just great TV, I guess. I thought there were too many moderators, too much interaction with the audience. I hate it when the audience chimes in. I agree with Ira. I'd like it to be in a closed room. I don't think we need the audience reaction. But it does make good TV.
Well, there are a lot of things I'd like to see. For example, we heard from many people who said, how dare you? Why wasn't this on public radio? Well, the answer is it was an NBC spectacular. And I think when it's something that's important, it ought to be offered to everybody. Hmm. But tough darts, you know, that's just not the way it is.
Exactly. Up to the
Democratic National Committee.
Yeah, the DNC, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they offer the debates to the networks, but chose not to offer a debate to Fox.
So there will be more debates. But this does go back to the original content topic that we were talking about here, which is people aren't reading as much. Of course, for a long time, people have gotten most of their national news from television. And increasingly, by the way, digital is even with television in terms of where people get their news. That is, as of last year. But the fact is that the attention span that we have and our desire to have those electric moments when we can actually see things happening, you can see why that affects both people's preference, why they turn to television instead of taking the time to read, and why they're looking for that quick moment, that burst of intensity that you can get from broadcast that you can't get when you're reading it in print.
And you can get it even quicker on Twitter.
Yeah. It just comes out, speaking of the president, President Twitter. Yeah.
Well, this is a process after which Donald Trump got elected, when he was one of 17 and a long shot, and he manipulated the debates. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, but he was smart enough to navigate those debates and came out ahead. So I just wonder if this is the best way to elect a president.
But he's always been so good at this. I mean, look at the North Korean incident, where the president stepped across the border into North Korea. And this became a big news event. But nothing substantive happened, right?
Well, it's all symbolic.
It is symbolic, but it was actually a great Donald Trump reality TV production because it was live. It was his biggest live audience ever. How impressive is that, huh?
On the other hand, he stepped across that border and heard a lot from an awful lot of people who say this is the worst dictator in the world, and he is supporting him and calling him his friend. I think, you know, it doesn't go only one way.
Hmm. You know, and the new press secretary is getting a lot of kudos for clearing the way for their clearing the path so the U.S. media could get in and photograph this. But obviously, this is something that the president wanted her to do. So she was actually doing a very good job for her boss.
Right. I'm not sure she would have been clearing the way. They say she actually got bruised. Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure she would have gotten black and blue clearing the way for reporters to cover something less favorable for the president. Right. Maybe I'm being cynical. Sorry. With all due.
Well, time will tell.
Time will tell. Stephanie.
Well, maybe I'm being cynical, but I was watching that again and again and again where she supposedly had been roughed up. And frankly, I didn't see it.
Oh, really?
Well, she was sort of squeezed against the banister there, so that might have been where it occurred.
Yeah, well.
It makes a good story anyway. Yeah. Has anybody seen the bruises? No.
Yeah.
By the way, did you guys talk about the Sarah Sanders going away party? Did that come up on this program?
Why don't you do it?
Some of the reporters threw a going away party for Sarah Sanders, and according to the reports, some of the reporters who showed up said to their colleagues, don't let anybody know I'm here. Don't use my name. the whole point of it was the hypocrisy of Sarah Sanders treating the reporters in that White House press room like crap for months and months and months, and now she's leaving and they're going to go fete her, F-E-T-E. Mm-hmm. The hypocrisy on the press's side, frankly, is stunning to me.
It is amazing. We have there is always a contentious relationship at some point between the White House press secretary, between any press secretary and the media. You know, we deal with press secretaries all the time for politicians, and you're always contesting them. You're always pushing them back and forth. But there has never, I don't think, been a press secretary who was as overtly hostile and has done more to block media access to the principal.
Yeah, but look at who the boss is. I mean, part of her problem is that she does have, in my opinion, the worst president we've ever had in this country as her boss calling the shots. And she just stepped in line and did what he wanted.
You know, whether she was a good press secretary or a bad press secretary, I don't think anybody should go and have a party for. I don't think journalists should be doing that.
Well, I agree with that. It just overall. Yeah.
But if you're that press secretary, you hope to maintain a collaborative, collegial. You mm-hmm. need to try to maintain a relationship with reporters, even at times when you don't want them poking your nose into things that you're doing. It is just by the very nature of the job, it's difficult. And the question is whether it affects the coverage. If a press secretary has a better relationship with reporters, does that help the principal get better coverage? Does it make any difference?
Well, part of it has to do with outright bribery. In other words, we can help you. We can give you a good placement in a press conference. We can give you a story that you might not have gotten if you're cooperative. That kind of thing does go on.
Well, people actually do make data and information available to reporters. It is not at all unusual for somebody who's inside government to leak material that is to the benefit of one person or another. And that's true of press secretaries, too. I can give you something here, for example, they'll say on the president's opponent or on somebody else. And if you're a reporter, you will take that information and make use of it appropriately, not because you're biased, but because we take information from all sources, right?
You know, I always told reporters that press secretaries, public relations people, they're not your friends. Don't make them your friends. They are using you like you are using them. And just be cognizant of that all the time.
And yet sometimes there is respect, even though it's harsh. The founder of this program with Alan, Gary Fryer, who was Mario Cuomo's press secretary, was somebody who did battle with the press every day, but was respected. We never thought that Gary Fryer was lying to us. He was aggressive. He would not always be our friend in trying to get information, but we didn't think he was lying to us. So there's a model. We're out of time.
No.
That's so true. You can go back and finish your now you can have your lunch, Alan. That's be just fine. Take the time.
Just feed the dog, answer the phone.
Yeah. The thing I've always loved about you, Rex, is how kind you are. Thank you
very kindly. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank our producer, Dave Agostina, and we thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.